So Lodsey came, and with him came Major General Carrington and Major Robert Stevenson, Smythe Baden-Powell, who would one day coin the motto, Be Prepared. And behind them came the guns and the soldiers. The women and children danced out from the lager at Bulawayo with bouquets of wild flowers for them, and they sang, For They Are Jolly Good Fellows, and wept with joy. The senior indunas of Kumalo, betrayed by the Amlimo's promises of divine intervention, uncertain and with the fire in their bellies swiftly cooling, squabbling amongst themselves and awed by the massive show of military force that they had provoked, withdrew slowly with their impis from the vicinity of Bulawayo. The imperial troops sortied in great lumbering columns and swept the valleys and the open land. They burned the deserted villages, the standing crops, and they drove away the few cattle that the rinderpest had spared. They shelled the hills where they suspected the Matabele might be hiding, and they rode their horses to exhaustion, chasing the elusive black shadows that flitted through the forest ahead of them. The Maxims fired until the water in the cooling jackets boiled, but the range was 900 yards or more, and the targets were as fleet as rabbits. So the weeks dragged on and became months, and the soldiers tried to starve the Matabele and force them into a set-piece battle. But the Indunas sulked in the broken ground and took refuge in the Matopos Hills, where the guns and the soldiers dared not follow them. Occasionally, the Matabele caught an isolated patrol or a man on his own. Once even the legendary Frederick Salus, elephant hunter and adventurer extraordinary. Salus had dismounted to pot one of the rebels that were disappearing over the ridge ahead, when a stray bullet grazed his pony, and his usually impeccably behaved animal bolted and left him stranded. Only then he realized that he had outridden the main body of his scouts, and that the Matabele were instantly aware of his predicament. They turned back and coursed him like dogs on a hare. It was a race the likes of which Salus had not run since his elephant hunting days. The barefooted and lightly equipped Amadorda gained swiftly, so close at last that they freed their blades from the thongs and began that terrible humming war chant. Only then Lieutenant Windley, Salus' second in command, spurred in, and pulling his foot from the left stirrup, gave Salus the leather, and galloped with him into the ranks of the oncoming scouts. At other times the swing of fortune was towards the soldiers, and they would surprise a foraging patrol of Matabele at a drift, or in thick bush, and hang them from the nearest trees that would bear the weight. It was an inconclusive, cruel little war, and it drew on and on. The military officers who were conducting the campaign were not businessmen. They did not think in terms of cost efficiency, and the bill for the first 3 months was £1,000,000 of sterling, a cost of £5,000 per head of Matabele killed. The bill was for the account of Mr. Cecil John Rhodes and his British South Africa Company. In the Matopos Hills, the Indunas were forced towards starvation, and in Bulawayo, Mr. Rhodes was forced just as inexorably towards bankruptcy. The three riders moved in a cautious, mutually protective spread. They kept to the centre of the track. Their rifles were loaded and cocked and carried at high port. Jan Sharoot rode point, 50 yards ahead, his little woolly head turned tirelessly from side to side as he searched the bush on each side. Behind him came Louise Ballantyne, delighting in her escape from the confinements of the Bulawayo Lager after these weary months. She rode astride, with all the elan of a natural horsewoman, and there was a feather in her little green cap, and when she turned to look back every few minutes, her lips parted in a loving smile. She was not yet accustomed to having Zuga with her once again, and she had constantly to reassure herself. Zuga was 50 yards behind her, and he answered her smile in a way that wrenched something deep inside her. He sat easy and straight in the saddle, the wide-brimmed slouch hat slanted over one eye. The sun had gilded away the pallor of Holloway Jail, and the silver and gold of his beard gave him the air of a Viking chieftain. In that extended order, they rode up from the grassy plains under the high arched branches of the Masasa trees, up the first slope of the hills, and as they reached the false crest, Jan Sharoot stood in his stirrups and shouted with relief and delight. Unable to contain themselves, Louise and Zuga cantered forward and reined in beside him.
"Oh, thank you. Thank you, Lord," Louise whispered huskily, and reached across for Zuga's hand.
"It's a miracle," he
he said softly, and squeezed her fingers. Ahead of them, the mellow thatch of King's Lynn basked comfortably in the sunlight. It seemed to be the most beautiful sight either of them had ever looked upon. Untouched? Louise shook her head in wonder. Must be the only homestead in Matabele land that wasn't burned. Oh, come on, my darling, she cried with sudden ecstasy. Let's go back to our home. Zugo restrained her at the steps of the wide front porch, and made her stay in the saddle, her rifle at the ready, holding the reins of their horses while he and Jan Sharoot searched the homestead for any sign of Matabele treachery. When Zuga came out onto the stoop again, he carried his rifle at the trail and smiled at her. It's safe. He helped her down from the saddle, and while Jan Sharoot led the horses away to stall feed them in the stables from the grain bags he had brought, Zuga and Louise went up the front steps hand in hand. The thick ivory curves of the old bull elephant's tusks still framed the doorway to the dining room, and Zuga stroked one of them as he passed. Your good luck charms, Louise chuckled indulgently. The household gods, he corrected her, and they passed between them into the house. The house had been looted. They could not have expected less, but the books were still there, thrown from the shelves, some with their spines broken, or with the leather boards damaged or gnawed by rats. But they were all there. Zuga retrieved his journals and dusted them superficially with his silk scarf. There were dozens of them, the record of his life, meticulously handwritten and illustrated with ink drawings and coloured maps. "It would have truly broken my heart to have lost these," he murmured, piling them carefully on the library table and stroking one of the red Morocco covers. The silver was lying on the dining-room floor, some of it battered, but most of it intact. It had no value to a Matabele. They wandered through the rambling homestead, through the rooms that Zuga had added haphazardly to the original structure, and they found small treasures amongst the litter. A silver comb he had given her on their first Christmas together, the diamond and enamel dress studs which had been her birthday present to him. She handed them back to him, and went on tiptoe to offer her face to his kiss. There was still crockery and glassware on the kitchen shelves, though all the pots and knives had been stolen, and the doors to the pantry and storerooms had been broken off their hinges. "It won't take much to fix," Zuga told her. "I can't believe how lucky we've been." Louise went out into the kitchen yard and found four of her red Rhode Island hens scratching in the dust. She called Jan Sharoot from the stable and begged a few handfuls of grain from the horses' feed bags. When she clucked at the hens, they came in a flutter of wings to be fed. The glass in the windows of the main bedroom was smashed, and wild birds had come through to roost in the rafters. The bedspread was stained with their excrement, but when Louise stripped it off, the linen and mattress beneath it were clean and dry. Zuga put an arm around her waist, squeezed it, and looked down at her, in the way she knew so well. "You're a wicked man, Major Ballantyne," she breathed huskily. "But there are no curtains on the windows." "Fortunately, there are still shutters." He went to close them, while Louise folded back the sheet, and then unfastened the top button of her blouse. Zuga returned in time to assist her with the others. An hour later, when they came out again onto the front stoop, they found Jan Sharoot had dusted off the chairs and table and unpacked the picnic basket they had brought from Bulawayo. They drank fine Constantia wine and ate cold Cornish pasties, while Jan Sharoot waited upon them and regaled them with anecdotes and reminiscences of the exploits of Ballantyne's scouts. "There were none like us," he declared modestly. "Ballantyne's scouts. The Matabele learned to know us well." "Oh, don't let's talk about war," Louise pleaded. But Zuga asked with good-natured sarcasm, "What happened to all your heroes? The war still goes on, and we need men like you." "Master Ralph changed," said Jan Sharoot darkly. "He changed just like that," he snapped his fingers. "From the day we caught Butso at the Valley of the Goats, he wasn't interested any more. He never rode with the scouts again, and within a week he'd gone back to the railhead to finish building his railway. They say he will drive the first train into Bulawayo before Christmas. That's what they say." "Enough," Louise declared. It's our first day at King's Lynn in almost a year. I will not have another word of war. Pour some wine, Jan Cheroot, and take a little sip for yourself. Then she turned to Zuga. Darling, can't we leave Bulawayo and come back here? Zuga shook his head regretfully. I'm sorry, my love. I could not risk your precious life. The Matabele are still in rebellion, and this is so isolated. From the back of the house came the sudden shriek and cackle of alarmed poultry. Zuga broke off and jumped to his feet. As he reached for his rifle propped against the wall, he said softly but urgently, Jan Cheroot, go round the back of the stables. I'll come from the other side. Then to Louise, wait here, but be ready to run for the horses if you hear a shot. And the two men slipped silently away down the veranda. Zuga reached the corner of the wall below the main bedroom, just as there was another storm of squawks and cackles, and the beating of wings. He ducked around the corner and sprinted down the thick whitewashed wall that protected the kitchen yard, and flattened himself beside the gate. Above the cacophony of terrified chickens and the flapping of wings, he heard a voice say, "Hold that one! Do not let it go!" The voice was Matabele, and almost immediately a half-naked figure ducked through the doorway beside Zuga, carrying a chicken in each hand. One thing only prevented Zuga firing. The pendulant bare breasts that flapped against the Matabele's ribs as she ran. Zuga smashed the butt of his rifle between the woman's shoulders, knocking her to the earth, and he leapt over her body into the kitchen yard. Beside the kitchen door stood Jan Cheroot. He held his rifle in one hand, and in the other the skinny, naked, struggling body of a small black boy. "Shall I knock his head in?" Jan Cheroot asked. "You are no longer a member of Ballantyne's scouts," Zuga told him. "Just keep a hold on him, but don't hurt him." And he turned back to examine his own prisoner. She was an elderly Matabele woman, almost on the point of starvation. She must once have been a big, heavily fleshed woman, for her skin hung loosely upon her in folds and wrinkles. Once those breasts must have been the size of watermelons, and almost bursting with fat. But now they were empty pouches that dangled almost to her navel. Zuga caught her wrist and hauled her to her feet. He marched her back into the kitchen yard, and he could clearly feel the bones of her arm through the wasted flesh. Jan Cheroot was still holding the boy, and now Zuga studied him briefly. He also was skeletally thin. Each rib and each knob of his spine poked through the skin, and his head seemed too big for his body, and his eyes too big for his head. "Little bugger is starving," said Zuga. "That's one way of getting rid of them," Jan Cheroot agreed. And at that moment Louise stepped into the kitchen doorway, with the rifle still in her hand, and her expression changed the instant she saw the black woman. "Juba?" she said. "Is that you, Juba?" "Oh, Balela," the Matabele woman whimpered. "I had thought never to see the sunshine of your face again." "What now?" said Zuga grimly. "We have caught ourselves a pretty prize, Jan Cheroot. The senior wife of the great and noble Induna Gandang, and this puppy must be his grandson. I didn't recognize either of them. They're on their last legs." Tungata Zebiwe sat in his grandmother's bony lap and ate with a quiet frenzy, the total dedication of a starving animal. He ate the extra Cornish pasties from the picnic basket, then he ate the crusts that Zuga had left. Louise searched the saddlebags and found a battered tin of bully, and the child ate that also, stuffing the rich fatty meat into his mouth with both hands. "That's right," said Jan Cheroot sourly. "Fatten him up now, so we have to shoot him later." And he went off sulkily to saddle the horses for the return to Bulawayo. "Juba, little dove," Louise asked. "Are all the children like this?" "The food is finished," Juba nodded. "All the children are like this, though some of the little ones are dead already." "Juba, is it not time that we women put an end to the foolishness of our men, before all the children are dead?" "It is time, Balela," Juba agreed. "Time and past time."
"Who is this woman?" Mr. Rhodes asked, in that exasperated high-pitched voice that betrayed his agitation, and he peered at Zuga. His eyes seemed to have taken a new prominence. as though they were being squeezed out of his skull. "She is the senior wife of Gandang."
"Gandang? He commanded the impi that massacred Wilson's patrol on the Shangani."
"He was a half-brother to Lobengula. With Babian and Somabula, he is the senior of all the Indunas."
"I don't suppose there is anything to lose by talking to them," Mr. Rhodes shrugged. "This business will destroy us all if it goes on much longer. Tell this woman to take a message back that the Indunas must lay down their arms and come in to Bulawayo."
"I'm sorry, Mr. Rhodes," Zuga told him. "They won't do that. They have had an indaba in the hills. All the Indunas have spoken, and there is only one way."
What is that, Ballantyne?"
"They want you to go to them."
"Me? Personally?"
Mr. Rhodes asked softly. "We will speak only to Lodzi, and he must come to us unarmed. He must come into the Matopas without the soldiers. He may bring three other men with him, but none of them must carry a weapon. If they do, we will kill them immediately." Zuga repeated the message that Juba had brought out of the hills for them. And Mr. Rhodes closed his eyes and covered them with the palm of his hand. His voice wheezed painfully in his chest, so that Zuga had to lean forward to catch his words.
"In their power," he said, "alone and unarmed, completely in their power."
Mr. Rhodes dropped his hand and stood up. He moved heavily to the opening of the tent. He clasped his hands behind his back and rocked back on his heels. Outside, in the hot, dusty noon, a bugle sang the advance, and there was the distant sound of a cavalry troop leaving the laager. Hooves and the rattle of the lance butts in their hard leather boots. Mr. Rhodes turned back to Zuga.
"Can we afford to trust them?" he asked.
"Can we afford not to, Mr. Rhodes?"